I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning? Because you see it gets on the lungs and it does a tremendous number of lungs. So it'd be interesting to check that.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. To the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, from Pacifica Radio, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. Elsewhere in California, on KFOI Red Bluff Redding, KKRN Round Mountain, KGOE Eureka. In Oregon, on KYAQ in the Central Coast, KSO in Cottage Grove, and KEPW in Eugene. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania, on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii, KAKU, Columbus, Ohio, WGRN, Palinville, New York, WLPP, Grand Rapids, Michigan, WPRR, New Orleans, Louisiana, WHIV, Gallup, New Mexico, KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire, WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas, KPSQ, Seattle, Washington, KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin, WADR, Minneapolis, St. Paul, AM 950, KTNF, and coast to coast and around the globe, streaming on the internets on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, Deprogrammed Radio, and Detour Talk. Blanketing the globe 5 days a week, usually hosted by Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com, but today I'm back. I'm Nicole Sandler, host of The Nicole Sandler Show, based at NicoleSandler.com. And I'm happy to step in and help out Brad and Desi because we're all in this together. All right, so we have a busy show for you today. Coming up, a conversation with MSNBC's Ali Velshi and another edition of a new feature that I started on my program. I call it Quarantine Calling because everyone all around the world is basically in the same boat. We're all experiencing the coronavirus crisis together. And in most countries, people are social distancing and are quarantining at home. So I started calling around the world and finding out how others are faring in this very weird time in our history. So in a little bit, we'll check in with someone in Finland, where it's very cold. But we'll begin, as we usually do, with the latest news. So Donald Trump, Friday afternoon, signed into law the latest coronavirus relief package. The Senate approved it on Tuesday, the House passed it on Thursday, and finally, you know, Donald Trump signed it on Friday. The deal provides $310 billion to replenish the Paycheck Protection Program to help small businesses continue paying employees as the crisis shuts down much of the economy. Plus, it allots another $60 billion for a separate emergency loan and grant program involving small banks in rural and suburban areas, $75 billion for hospitals and healthcare providers, and another $25 billion for coronavirus testing. It should be noted, though, that that $25 billion for coronavirus testing is the reason this bill was delayed a week, as Republicans and the White House fought that provision that the Democrats were finally successful in getting included. More testing. But it was at that signing in the Oval Office that Donald Trump lied to us yet again. I know that's nothing new, but this, what the lie was about, is truly astounding. And, you know, just when you wondered why people still watch Trump's daily 2-hour free campaign infomercial, it's for those unbelievable moments like we witnessed on Thursday. Here's what happened. Donald Trump introduced a Homeland Security official who explained that sunlight and bleach can kill the coronavirus on surfaces. So Donald Trump, stable genius that he is, suggested treating COVID-19 patients by hitting their lungs with ultraviolet or very powerful light, or possibly injecting them with disinfectant. Honestly, I couldn't make this stuff up if I tried.
I have, Bill, a question that probably some of you are thinking of if you're totally into that world, which I find to be very interesting. So supposing we hit the body with a tremendous, whether it's ultraviolet or just very powerful light. And I think you said that hasn't been checked, but you're going to test it. And then I said, supposing you brought the light inside the body, which you can do either through the skin or in some other way. And I think you said you're going to test that, too. Sounds interesting.
We'll get the right folks who could.
Right. And then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning? Because you see it gets on the lungs and it does a tremendous number in the lungs. So it'd be interesting to check that. So that you're going to have to use medical doctors with. But it sounds interesting to me. So we'll see. But the whole concept of the light, the way it kills it in 1 minute, that's pretty powerful.
Okay. Now, obviously, Donald Trump doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. But you heard what he said there. And when he was talking about, you'll test that, right? You'll test that. He said for both things, both the ultraviolet light and the injection of the disinfectant, he was talking to Bill Bryan. Well, Friday, when he's signing the coronavirus relief package in the Oval Office, after enduring a day's worth of taunts and laughter and disbelief that this man could be such a moron, he tried to backtrack. So when he was signing this in the Oval Office, there was a pool spray, a handful of reporters who were in there to cover it. And he was asked about his recommendations, and he actually said this.
Not encouraging Americans to...
No, of course. That was, interior-wise, it's said sarcastically. It was put in the form of a question to a group of extraordinarily hostile people.
No,
namely,
it wasn't.
The fake news media. Oh, okay.
Some doctors thought they needed to clarify that after.
Well, of course. All they had to do was see. It was just, you know, the way it was asked. I was looking at you.
I know.
You're looking at Dr. Burns.
What's that?
You were looking at Dr. Burke.
I was looking at Bill.
Bill.
I was looking at the doctor. I was looking at some of the reporters. I don't know if you were there. Were you there? I don't think you were there.
I was there, and
No, not you. You were there. If you're there, I never forget. You were...
I wasn't there yesterday.
You were not?
No, sir.
Yeah, I didn't think you were there. Okay.
Mr. President, I know that you continue to say you obviously...
Okay, hold it 1 second. Any other questions from any other people?
Wow. So that journalist that he just cut off was Weijia Jiang of CBS News, with whom he had a bit of a tussle earlier in the week. And now she's trying to follow up on this question and he cuts her off. He is just a reprehensible, sad excuse for a human being. By the way, he talked about the hostile journalists who were in the room. Here's another question from Thursday as he was pushing these ridiculous I don't want to call them remedies because they're things that can kill you. He was asked about the wisdom of promoting such things by Philip Rucker of the Washington Post, and this is how the president treated him.
Respectfully, sir, you're the president, and people tuning into these briefings, they want to get information and guidance and want to know what to do. They're not looking for rumors.
I'm the president, and you're fake news. And you know what I'll say to you? I'll say very nicely, I know you well. I know you well, because I know the guy. I see what he writes. He's a total faker. So are you ready? It's just a suggestion from a brilliant lab by a very, very smart, perhaps brilliant man. He's talking about sun. He's talking about heat. And you see the numbers. So that's it. That's all I have. I'm just here to present talent. I'm here to present ideas. Because we want ideas to get rid of this thing. And if heat is good, and if sunlight is good, that's a great thing as far as I'm concerned. Go ahead.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like he was being sarcastic to get at the press. By the way, in case you're wondering what people around the world think of the advice being given by the American president, here's a clip from Friday morning's Good Morning Britain television show.
Do you know, I've heard some crazy things in my life, but this is probably one of the craziest. To use a disinfectant and inject it into the human body is not only toxic and highly poisonous, but would do no good whatsoever. It would cause inflammation of human tissues and not touch the virus at all, which actually lives in human cells, not on the surface of them. So he's completely and utterly crazy to even suggest this. Secondly, his other suggestion was to use the power of sunlight.
Yes.
In that some sort of sunlight inside the body would eradicate the virus. Again, the virus lives inside cells and replicates inside cells. It is true that the virus decays outside of the human body in ultraviolet light from the sun, but inside the body, of course, sunlight would do absolutely nothing. And then how could you get sunlight into the human body? I think this all stems from the fact that President Trump probably thinks that sunlight emerges from parts of his body.
touche. All right. There's a bit of breaking news as we're going to press. Top Navy officials are recommending that Captain Brett Crozier, remember him? He's the former commanding officer of the aircraft carrier USS Theodore Roosevelt, be reinstated to his position. This according to a senior defense official with knowledge of the decision. Now, this decision, which still must be approved by the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, follows the resignation of the then acting Navy Secretary Thomas Modley. He's the guy who publicly criticized Crozier for how he handled a coronavirus outbreak on his ship. Crozier lost his command after he sent a letter requesting help from Navy leaders. The letter was leaked to the media. Crozier pleaded for more resources as the virus, which has now infected more than 800 sailors, raced through the ship. Amazing. And finally, we've passed another grim milestone. Sometime Friday morning, the reported death toll from COVID-19 in the United States passed the 50,000 mark. 50,000 Americans dead in 2 months. Stay safe, everyone. Stay home. Seriously. Coming up next, we're going to check in with someone else far, far away to see how they're coping with the quarantine, the virus, the insanity in today's world. It's a segment I call Quarantine Calling. Finland, here we come. I'm Nicole Sandler, your guest host today on the broadcast. Welcome back to the broadcast. I'm Nicole Sandler, your guest host today, with a bit of a palate cleanser in between the news and the interview coming up with Ali Velshi. We are making another connection. It's a segment I've started calling Quarantine Calling. To tell you how this came about, I stumbled upon this Facebook group called A View From My Window. And I've noticed these amazing photos that people are posting from all over the world of, as the name says, the view from outside their window as we're all stuck inside dealing with this coronavirus that has put the entire planet on lockdown. So joining me now from Vaasa, Finland, Hanna Turpinen. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Close?
Yes, Hanna Turpinen. Yeah, you pronounce it really well.
Oh, well, thank you. And it's a pleasure to meet you. You posted a gorgeous photo of a very snowy backyard. How's the weather in Finland today?
Well, right now, I'm sitting in my glass porch, so it's still sunny. It's about 10 degrees Celsius, so it's not too bad, but it could be warmer. But that day, we were already looking at springtime and tulips and other flowers blooming, and all of a sudden there was another snowstorm, so that sort of caught us by surprise.
Now,
we're all with that now.
There are some states here in the U.S. that are also having horrible winter storms now, and it's April 16th today.
I noticed. Actually, I noticed in the group that you were mentioning, the wonderful view from my window group. So. Mm-hmm. So I noticed that there's a lot of snow in some northern parts
Now,
the U.S. as well.
I happen to be in South Florida, so we're having a heat wave down here. It's been in the 90s
actually, Fahrenheit. Yeah, it's quite warm. So
that's
at least
wonderful.
We have that going for us. So if we're stuck, at least we can go out in the backyard and get some sun. So what? How did this unfold in Finland, the whole staying at home? When did you guys get alerted that there was this pandemic brewing and that things were going to change?
Wow, when was that? Was sometime in February. It's actually, I find it kind of hard to keep track of time. I can't even, is it fourth or fifth week that I'm working from home now? I'm not even sure. But it was sometime at the end of February. First, it was still called an epidemic somewhere in northern Italy, parts of Switzerland, then suddenly Spain, Germany, and then, then it reached us as well. It's not all that bad yet, but the peak of the epidemic, we haven't reached that yet, I think.
Uh-huh.
They're about, Finland is quite scarcely populated, so there's a lot of space. So I think things are not evolving that fast here. So there are about, 3,000 and a half cases right now. But we're still expecting the peak of the epidemic.
Yeah, it's scary. So is there an order to shelter at home, or is this voluntary? What's the mandate?
Well, a bit of the both. We're not in a lockdown. We're not in a current quarantine state. We can move about freely outside, but gatherings above 10 people are prohibited.
Mm-hmm.
The schools are closed. The university, I work at the University of Vasa, so we're closed. We can't even enter the buildings without permission, so we're working from home. So we're basically, a lot of people are working from home, but the shops are still open.
Oh, really?
We can go out. We can go out to exercise. The restaurants are closed. They can only sell food as takeout menus. And
How is the medical care system in Finland?
In Finland.
Are you taken care of? It's a universal health care provided by the government, paid for by your taxes?
Yes, it's actually, it's excellent. We do pay a lot of taxes, but our social security system is really good. So we pay something if we end up in a hospital, but that's only like a really small fraction of the actual costs. And they're trying to flatten the curve so that in case there's a huge epidemic here, there'd be enough places in intensive care units. And as it seems right now, that's what they're managing to do. So people that end up in the hospitals are in moderate. I think some 200 or 300 have ended up in hospitals.
That's not bad. The much smaller population over there than here, certainly. But it sounds like they've got a handle on it, and people are at least observing the social distancing and trying to keep it from spreading.
That's something really characteristic of my nation. I think we're really known to keeping our personal space so that. It's easy to follow the orders to not go too close to other people.
You said you work at the university. What do you do there?
Yeah. I work at the HR, and I work with international HR. So I help new foreign or international researchers when they settle in and move to Finland, and when our researchers are going out for research exchanges to other countries. So this affects my job quite a lot, actually.
Oh, sure. I bet. Well, obviously the university is closed. All schools are here are closed as well. Kids are, parents are having to do homeschooling and work with e-learning programs. So it's a whole new world. Thankfully, my daughter is out of school, so I don't have to deal with that.
Yeah.
But we're navigating different things. So at university, same thing there is public, is higher education also included in in your taxes. So when a child finishes high school, they get to go to university, and that's also paid for?
Yes, it's so there are entrance exams. Those who get in get a free schooling.
Wow. And you hear the incredulity in my voice, because I'm sure you sound like you know what's going on, and you know what the system is like over here in the U.S.
It's I do.
Insane.
Yeah. So I have a 10-year-old son, so I don't have to worry about getting him to school or start saving for his university education. That sort of included in my monthly taxes that I pay.
Wow. So. Yeah. Here, you know, there's a lot. So many people are now unemployed because with businesses shutting down, people,
yeah,
as of today,
here,
5.5 million horrible. More people filed for unemployment benefits in this past week, bringing it to 22 million people in just 4 weeks. So the unemployment is crazy. And unfortunately, in this nation, it's so nuts that your health care in many cases is tied to your employment. It's provided. Insurance is provided by the employer. So all these people who are newly unemployed now find themselves without health insurance, and people are really scared because if they do get sick and go to the hospital, they're going to wind up with a huge bill that could bankrupt them, that could destroy their lives going forward. It's really insane.
Really, it's heartbreaking. It's really breaks my heart even to think about that.
Yeah.
Another worry besides this virus itself.
Right. To have to think about paying for it. I'm wondering how, obviously here in the States, we think everything revolves around us. I'm wondering what kind of coverage there is of how we're handling it over here. We have, I don't know your views of him. My view of the guy in the White House right now is that he's an insane madman who is not only destroying this nation, but he's doing his damnedest to destroy the planet. We are in desperate straits over here with this guy in the White House, and just hoping we make it to November so we can vote him out of office. I'm wondering what the coverage is like over there in Finland of him. Did the rest of the world see him as insane as most of us do?
Well, he gets a lot of, highlights in the news.
Yeah, a lot of coverage, right?
Because, yes, coverage. The decisions are quite abrupt, like the decision to shut down the financing for the
WHO?
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
I feel like when I make these calls to talk to people around the world, like I have to apologize for him to the rest of the world. I am so sorry that a faction of the people in this country voted this idiot into office. I'm mortified by him. And we're all just like holding our breath, hoping we make it through to November and can get him out of office, because it's not only embarrassing, but cutting off funding to the World Health Organization in the middle of a global pandemic, it's unconscionable. And so, again, I, on behalf of my fellow Americans, I apologize.
Yeah, well, politics, what can you do? Yeah.
What's the government like over in Finland?
In Finland, right now, we have a kind of new government. Our prime minister is youngest female prime minister in the world.
Oh, really? So I thought that was New Zealand. That's Finland, huh?
She just started her term not too long ago, and boy, what a start of the term for her. But
good or bad?
Doing a great job, though. Good. Tough decisions, but I'm really proud of her and her government. They're doing a good job.
Oh, that's great. So glad to hear it. And I think, look, we've got some young people in Congress that I'm hoping will work their way up, because it's time for a change in leadership. I'm also kind of upset about the choices we have to replace Donald Trump in November. We're down to Joe Biden, who was not my number one choice, but he'd be night and day better than Donald Trump. As I say all the time, my dog Jackson would do a better job as president than Donald Trump. So hopefully we'll be able to apologize to the rest of the world in a better way, at least come November, if we survive that long. I'm glad to hear that you've got a new young look. This is a trend, I guess, young women taking over, because the prime minister of New Zealand is also a young woman who's getting rave reviews for her work as well. So maybe this is a welcome new trend we're seeing.
Yeah. Well, I must say that they are doing a great job now. So all my best wishes and luck go to our new government.
Absolutely. Hannah Terpanian, it is so great to connect with you. That we're all in the same situation, no matter where we are on the planet, there's something kind of comforting
amazing.
About
and,
that, right? And I
and
just
somehow the group, the view of my window makes it so real.
Yeah.
To see.
Yeah.
We're all struggling with the same thing now.
We are. And I don't think we've ever had a moment like this in world history before where we were all going through a similar crisis together. And that's why I want to connect with people. I'm so glad you took a few minutes to talk with us today. It's a pleasure to meet you. I'd love to
it's
one
a pleasure
day in person.
To meet you too.
Thank you so much. And stay warm there in Finland. And
we will now. Summer is coming up, so... it's going to get sunnier and it's going to get warmer.
Awesome.
So that's one positive thing.
It is. It's after 7 p.m. there now, and I see it's still light outside. How late does it stay light?
Right now, maybe until 9 o'clock in the evening. But, you know, we're looking at a period when the sun never sets. So when it's midsummer here, it's gonna the sun is going to shine all night through. So
that's why
we'll need our thick black curtains again to be able to sleep.
And how warm does it get when the sun is out 24 hours a day?
The summers are really nice, about 20, 25 degrees, I'd say.
Celsius, so that's...
So for us, it's sort of a perfect temperature.
I hear you. All right, well, I'm spoiled. You know, I live in South Florida, so I don't deal with snow or any of that.
I do envy your heat wave right now, I must say.
Well, I'll send a little heat your way.
Thank you.
Virtually, anyway.
Stay safe.
And you too. And it's a pleasure meeting you and talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Her name is Hannah Terpanian, or thereabouts. I don't know about you, but maybe it's self-indulgent. But I love connecting with people all over the world. And this Facebook group, if you're on Facebook, I think you need an invite to join the group. So if you want an invite to, it's called View From My Window. People from every corner of the world posting pictures from the view outside their window as they're all shut in, hoping this virus passes us by. It is a small world, after all. I'm Nicole Sandler, in for Brad and Desi. Coming up next, a conversation with Ali Velshi. We'll be right back on the broadcast.
Daddy is a rare millionaire. I don't care. Yeah, you got the muscle. I got the muscle.
Welcome back to the broadcast. I'm your guest host, Nicole Sandler, coming to you from quarantine time in South Florida. We're all trying to adjust to life in different circumstances. And one group of people who has a particularly challenging time of it are the people we watch on TV every day delivering the news. That's what I wanted to discuss with MSNBC's Ali Velshi. He's somebody that, well, we welcome into our homes all the time. I've become a big fan of Ali Velshi's. In fact, I started really following you, Ali, when you joined Al Jazeera America. Because I was excited that for the first time in this era, we had a news channel that was about news. It wasn't about one ideology over another. The goal there was to present news in an objective manner, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was two goals. One is news in the absence of, what we used to think of as news, being as objective as possible. And we can discuss what objectivity is, because I think we've learned over time that maybe it's not exactly what we think it is. But that was one of the goals. And the other goal that I thought was really important is because I'd been a journalist probably 20 some odd years before I joined Al Jazeera. And we were really concentrated on telling stories from the perspective of the voiceless, or being a voice for the voiceless. And it occurred to me, while I had always thought about those things and I thought I was reporting about those things, my life as a journalist in New York City working for mainstream media Doesn't expose me to a whole lot of voiceless people as we go out of our way to find them. Mm-hmm. Even our most junior employees at a media organization are powerful, right? Because they can call up anybody and tell them they're from the media. Right. So it caused me to get outside of a zone in which I had been operating. It wasn't a shift in ideology for me or the way I think about things, but it really caused me to say, how do you tell stories from the perspective of the very people who don't have the voice, whom you talk about, whom you analyze, whom you characterize all the time? And I have to say, Nicole, that was a bigger challenge than a guy like me thought it was going to be. I thought this was obvious, right? I know who these voiceless people are. I know what their challenges are. I know what their lives are. Well, I didn't. Mm-hmm. And it changed my perspective. It was a remarkable experience for me for that reason.
And then, unfortunately, as these things happen, Al Jazeera didn't catch on here. Do you think it was more, because I enjoyed watching them. I like the objectivity. I'm always looking for it because it helps me organize my thoughts so I can be more objective about what I cover. And my show is not objective news coverage. It's opinion and commentary, but always based in fact. That's got to be the underlying basis. Otherwise, it's worthless. So I was bummed when it went away. And I wonder how much of it was xenophobia, was the fact that Al Jazeera was an Arabic network that was based in Qatar. And was that a big part of it?
So, you know, the other day somebody tweeted me something that was meant to be criticism and said, you know, how'd that Al Jazeera thing work out for you? And I said, did you watch it? And they said, no, I never did. It was biased. And I said, so you never watched anything on Al Jazeera America? And he said, no. And I said, would you mind looking some stuff up for me and letting me know what you thought was biased about that? So that was the problem. Those people who watched, even if they had political biases, we had people watching us who were conservative, who were liberal, but they felt that they could get the news. And those people who never did think so. And part of that was that logo, which was remarkable Arabic calligraphy. It was a competition that somebody won many years ago design the Al Jazeera logo, which to the untrained eye, including mine, looks a whole lot like ISIS's logo, frankly. Mm-hmm. We are not familiar with Arabic. We're certainly not familiar with Arabic calligraphy. Nope. And we're not familiar with Arabic anything, right? In North American society, there is no car, there is no chewing gum, there is no soft drink. Arabic to Americans for the last 25 years has generally speaking been associated with bad things, terrorism, Al-Qaeda, stuff like that. And that was very difficult to overcome. So I think that was a lot of it. So I don't think it's that people watched it and objected to it. I think the people who watched it actually came around to the idea that it was pretty good. There were some people who would just never watch it.
Exactly.
There were some cable carriers that would never carry it.
Yeah, it's that. It's the inbred bigotry. It's that institutional racism. Now, you, Ali Velshi, have made no secret of your background. You're a Kenyan-born Muslim who grew up in Canada, is now living and working here in the States. And I'm guessing that you've gotten both, kudos for that and some criticism because people are like that.
It comes up every few weeks. Somebody will tweet it, as if it's a criticism. It's like it's in my Twitter bio.
Right.
I was actually just annoyed because for a long time I was the most famous Kenyan-born Muslim I knew until Barack Obama showed up on the scene. I say it tongue in cheek to say I'm actually that guy, and he was never at any of the meetings.
Exactly.
To me, I did grow up in a world in which varied experience and diversity is of value. And that can be from anywhere. That could be socioeconomic, it could be where you are, where you're from, what you speak, what color you are, what gender you are, what you identify with. So I've never, ever, ever thought of that as a negative, right? To me, it's like, list the stuff you are and let people make what they will of it. Today, the concept of being foreign, immigrant, Muslim, global in perspective, Canada, some people associate with socialist. It's fascinating the buckets people will quickly put you into. I'm not actually that complex of being. I just sort of put it out there to say, hey, this is, if you wonder where my thinking comes from, if you wonder why I support single payer, healthcare, it's not actually a Bernie Sanders thing to me. It's the system in which I grew up. It's the system that I've studied, and it seems to work. That it happened to align for a few minutes with Bernie Sanders' campaign is interesting, but that's not where it came from with me. So I put it out there to say, whatever you think I think, because I'm a Kenyan-born Muslim who grew up in Canada, you're probably right.
Or not, because you're a human being and you're here. And for me, first and foremost, as a viewer and a power consumer of news media, you're one of the best. Now, I know we met virtually through Twitter some time ago when one morning I was in a pissy mood and I probably hadn't had enough coffee. And you said, I'm a big Bernie Sanders supporter for some of the reasons you already mentioned, the single payer and just his consistency over the years. And one morning, and it was like maybe only your second week in the new slot in the new Velshi show, which is now on Saturdays and Sundays from 8 to 10 Eastern morning. I'm, you know, one of those old people who doesn't sleep and wakes up early in the morning, so I see it all the time. Anyway, I called you out in a pissy moment, and you were so wonderful in the way you responded to me, and you really engaged with me. Some of your colleagues have blocked me over the years, and rightly so, probably. I blocked some of them, but I was so thrilled to have this conversation with you, and it verified my belief in that you're a good guy, you're a decent human being, and you're smart, and that's one of the reasons I enjoy watching you, because you do give a very well-rounded view of the whatever story you're talking about. You give background, and you do it without much personal commentary invoked. Although not that there's anything wrong with that. I do it on a daily basis, but you give us the facts, and especially at a time like this, that is so important. And that's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about today is how life reporting on the news has changed when we're living the biggest news story any of us has ever even imagined. The idea of a pandemic was always out there, and obviously the administration had been briefed on it too, not that they took it seriously, but we as a people, as a planet, have never lived through anything like this. How has it changed your world, other than obviously in the mechanics we see in the coverage and you're working from home? In a bigger picture, how has it changed you?
Well, on a few levels, first of all, for your comment, I don't really recall our fight. I recall the resolution. I recall the fact that we decided to engage and have a conversation. To me, that's the good part, right? I'm fine with criticism. We should often have it. And by the way, I think I was one of Bernie Sanders' last interviews before he stepped out of the race.
And I have to thank you for that too, by the way, because that did not go unnoticed, and it was a great interview too. So thank you for that.
We had a great interview, and I've always enjoyed a great relationship with the senator editorially, and I like that. So a lot of things have changed. I've covered a lot of the very big stories of our time. Right? I've covered I covered 9/11. I covered the recession. I covered I've covered hurricanes and earthquakes and wars. This is so different. Never mind the mechanics, which is fascinating, right? I'm broadcasting from my home right now. Actually, one of my colleagues, a photographer, is here adjusting some lighting and fixing some things. But the mechanics aside of anchoring a show, there's that. Then there's the actual news gathering, right? The idea that we have to tell real people stories. And that means going into places where real people are. And that this is a time when that's just weird, right? People don't necessarily want you coming into their homes. We're not out there all the time. So this Skype, Zoom, things like that have become much more valuable. But remember that we as a network operate on the basis that we have contact, who have our companies, who have communications experts. That regular folks don't have that stuff. Social media, Twitter, the stories about people's lives have become crucial and important. Frontline workers, right? I get outside in Manhattan at 7 p.m. every day and clap for those people out there, the frontline workers, including the grocery delivery people, the doormen, the nurses. But I don't talk to them. I don't interview them. So we've had to find ways to do that. And we do that. We are talking to home health care aides and grocery store workers and people like that to tell us what impact this has on them. And I think that's a part of our the new way we think about things that is going to be good, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe we can tell a lot more stories from the bottom up than we can from the perspective of presidents and princes and prime ministers down. So that's one very good part about this. But the other thing about it that's fascinating is in the big stories that I've covered, even in 9/11, we thought it was existential. We thought it was going to be a massive threat to our way of life, and ultimately it was, and it wasn't going to destroy us. And in the recession, we thought about all the ways in which it was going to damage our lives and our prosperity, but we weren't scared of the people around us. Mm-hmm. This is so new. You don't know where this threat lies. So your brain can't get your head around who fixes this. How does it get fixed? This is science. This is leadership. This is government. And we don't know how to process that. So we're doing it in real time. And you'll notice every single week on TV, our behavior changes a little bit because the story has shifted. Is it about fear? Is it about numbers? Is it about leadership? Is it about the economy? Is it about failures in government? Is it about medical science? So it's such a fast evolving story about things around which we don't have a pre-established expertise.
Right, right. And what I'm noticing also is we're all being affected by this in ways that we probably won't even know for months and maybe in some cases years to come. And I'm talking about mental health. And I'm somebody, I've been open about this on my show. I have always struggled with depression my entire adult life since adolescence. And I had a really, really rough time after Donald Trump's election, where I had I can look back now and describe it as a breakdown. Right. I did my job. I did a show every day. Don't ask me how I got through it. I'm afraid if I were to go back and listen to some of those shows, I'd be mortified because I got to the point where I had to write out every word. I was a nervous wreck. I questioned everything. And this is something I've been doing for 40 years. I've been in radio and I would shake before I opened the mic. It so thoroughly destroyed me. And I somehow got through it, came out on the other side, maybe seeing, all right, we're coming closer to an election time and maybe we can get rid of this man. But it has really affected me. And now, you know, just when we thought things couldn't get any worse, really, as a nation, as a planet, we're not going to go any lower, we get hit by this pandemic. And yeah. And so many of us are just, I'm a lung cancer survivor and I'm 60 years old. I can't go out there. So it's changed every aspect of our lives. And it's changed the way I do my show because no longer do I want to dig down deep on all the numbers and the news and it's too much. I want.
That's what we know.
Right. So I'm hitting on a more human level. I think I mentioned this to you in an email. I happened upon a Facebook group called View from My Room that now in a short month has over 1 million members who people at every corner of the planet, they take pictures of the view from their house, say where they are. They're everywhere from Zimbabwe to South Africa to Australia, New Zealand, and Bolivia, and Brazil, and all over the States. And I'm looking at these, and I start reaching out to some of these people and connecting with them, and I've invited them on the show. So I'm doing this new segment called Quarantine Calling, where I connected yesterday with a wonderful woman from Finland, somebody else in Denmark, somebody in Italy. And it just, it's a small world, and we're all on this in a unique moment in history when we're all experiencing basically the same thing. And I'm having a hard time verbalizing what that is, but just trying to connect with people. Those kind of stories are what somehow make me feel a little better, and it gives me a way to pass things along to listeners. Are you more interested in stuff like that? Because we also need you to help explain about the PPP program running out of money. And why some of us haven't gotten our $1,200 yet.
Yeah. And that is what we still do and what we still should do. But I have had segments on my shows that I have not had on my shows in 25 years or 30 years of doing this. I had an expert on grief the other day. Uh-huh. Talking about the collective grief we all feel, not just the grief of those of us who have lost somebody to COVID, but the feeling that we feel about the loss of normalcy in our lives actually feels like grief. And then there are those people who've lost somebody during this period, not to coronavirus, but they can't have a funeral or they can't be with them or they can't have a memorial service. I talked to somebody the other day about what young LGBTQ people go through, right? Because let's say you've had to leave school or leave your work and quarantine in place with your family, which wasn't safe space for you to start with.
Yeah.
I had someone talking about people who are abused in their relationships. Where do you go when
those
you got to actually be with someone and you can't run to the shelter and you don't have places that are open to you? So, you know, we would put we would give them tips as to what to do. What do you do if you suffer from anxiety? Or first of all, we're all sufferers of anxiety now. Those of us who didn't appreciate what anxiety was when people, you know, when you said, well, that's not really rational. What's your fear of that?
Of course
is.
Not.
It's like, guess what? We're all irrationally fearful all the time. Thank you for talking openly about your depression, because for people who are suffering from these things, this becomes that much more complicated. You don't have the same access to either therapists or medication or doctors that you typically have. And when everybody else is anxious, how do you share those concerns with people? And I feel like that is immediate and in the center of this conversation and necessary. We started running an ad on MSNBC probably 3 weeks ago. You know, we have the series that's called This Is Who We Are.
Uh-huh. Right.
And we changed it to We Are In This Together.
Uh-huh.
And it was just imagery of around the world and in America, the things people do to help other people in these times and to cope. I've invited people. I have a email address, mystory@velshi.com, to just tell me, how are you coping? Good, bad, send me videos, send me pictures. And we tell that story every show. I do an obituary every show.
Ooh.
Just to remember that these are real people's lives that were lived. And my producer, Emma, writes it, and she sends it to me, and I read it. And I always smile because the stories are so good. And then I always cry when I deliver them on TV. I've read it already. I know what it's going to say, and yet I can't keep it together. So these are ways in which we have changed. But I do agree with you. We have learned to find strength in each other. And that doesn't mean that you and I shouldn't argue on Twitter or we shouldn't have political arguments. I think we should. Somebody said to me last night, I did a webinar, and they said, do you think we can put aside our political bickering as we lead into the election to deal with this? And I said, no.
Yeah.
I said, people died for our right to politically bicker. You may call it bickering, and sometimes it feels like bickering, and sometimes it feels small and petty, but it is actually central to who we are. So for all we hate about coronavirus and being stuck in our homes, think about those people in the world who don't also have an election coming up in which they can vote, who don't have freedoms, who live in a refugee camp, who have no money at all, who live in abject poverty and can't do the things that we can do to social distance and keep clean all the time. We have democracy and we have a vote. And this is not the time to shy away from our adulthood and our democratic rights and our constitutional obligations for free speech. So bicker and fix coronavirus at the same time. We can actually walk and chew gum at the same time.
Most definitely. But then there's the other aspect that we've steered clear of so far, but it's the 239-pound and then some elephant in the room by way of Donald Trump, who, if you knew that we were going to be struck with a global pandemic of these proportions, this scary, who is the last person you'd want in the White House?
Right.
Donald Trump. And yet he goes up there, he commandeers two and a half hours of prime television time every night. I know MSNBC has gotten a little better at pulling away from him and trying to fact check him in real time. But to have him spout some of the crap he's spouting off is just so irresponsible and frightening. And it's, you know, my husband, I watch it because I say I have to. It's my job. I need to know what he's saying. And my husband can't be in the room. It's making him nuts. This is another aspect. I watch the way he berates journalists just doing their job. And if you're not complimentary of him, if you don't couch your question with praise, he'll call you the worst names that no adult should ever call anybody, let alone the president of the United States. I wonder on a daily basis, why don't these people get up and walk out? And then I answer my question and I say, because then all that would be left covering him is Fox and OANN. And that's as much of a disservice as covering this stuff.
The two things I always think journalists have to do, one is to bear witness, right? To tell people something is happening. And then you think about the Yazidis on Mount Sinjar, or you think about Darfur, or you think about the Rohingya. If there weren't somebody to tell you it was happening, we actually wouldn't know, because we'd all be on our feeds, which we have curated for ourselves, and the story wouldn't get there. So part of the reason we have to be in that room is to bear witness. Even if it's incredibly hard to watch. This is the president of the United States that was elected by American people, and the consequence of having that president is having that president, and we have to tell you that. But the other really important thing that you're getting at is the other responsibility that journalists have is to speak truth to power, to hold power to account. And there are some journalists in that room who on a daily basis, and by the way, it's not like anchoring a show where you've booked your guests, you know who they are, you've done research, you had a booker look into them, you've got a segment producer, you've read their articles. You have no idea on a daily basis what Donald Trump is going to do.
Nope.
And his mind works very differently than mine does. So I give a little extra credence to those reporters in that room, because he says stuff and then you have to decide, am I holding him to account for the thing that I thought I was holding him account for? Did he just say something really weird that I need to challenge, or do I need to get information on what they know? So it's hard. And there are some reporters, my friend Yamiche Alcindor from PBS, one of them, who, you know, he picks on her all the time. He belittles her all the time. He's got some bee in his bonnet about her, and she holds her patience and continues to ask her questions. And the other day when he skipped past her because he didn't want to give her another question, a couple reporters later, Jeremy Dimon from CNN took his opportunity and gave her the mic back.
Yes.
So there are some moments of glory in these things. But somebody said something to me before coronavirus when I was anchoring on Friday nights. I anchor Lawrence O'Donnell's show, Last Word. And she came on and she said, This is for grownups. This is not a time when you can say, this person's going to come in and save me. Mm-hmm. That's now not going to happen. So you are going to do the things you have to do, the most powerful of which remains your vote, others of which remain keeping your family safe, keeping yourself safe, social distancing where necessary, finding those around you who need resources, who you can help either figure out how to get their $1,200 or figure out how to file for unemployment, or if they don't file for unemployment, what can you do to help those around you? I have seen acts of kindness that I didn't know possible in the last couple of months. Just people saying, do you need money? Mm-hmm. Tweet me, need money. What you just said about talking to people, random people around the world, people saying, call me if you need someone to talk to. We're going to fix ourselves. We're going to take the mantle of leadership. And I will say one thing. When Joe Biden launched his campaign, he talked about recapturing the soul of America, and he talked about Charlottesville and how far we've come. You know, he's changed his whole theme now, and he's talking about who he's going to pick for his cabinet.
Yeah.
And if you think back to 2008, during the election, during the financial crisis, John McCain had been doing pretty well, and then he picked Sarah Palin as his running mate. And Barack Obama lined up with all of Clinton's senior economic advisors behind him. Basically, this is going to be the team that's going to help me out. And Joe Biden switched strategy to say, look, maybe you've got doubts about who I am or what my actual capabilities are, but I'm going to start to line up a team for you so you know who is going to lead you out of that. Interesting theory, given that America right now is so hungry for leadership. So that I think we're all pivoting and we're all making adjustments to say, you can watch that White House press briefing every day. Your solution and your leadership's not going to come from there. So find it where you can and find it in yourself if you can.
Right. Well, hopefully. I mean, then there are those of us waiting on the edges saying, OK, who Joe Biden assembles is of the utmost importance. If he goes back to the old well and brings in Larry Summers and Tim Geithner and the same old Clinton Obama crew, that's not going to do the trick. He needs to. I've already said I've got my my industrial strength nose clips from my lung cancer battle that I used for pulmonary testing. I used this in 2016 to vote for Hillary Clinton, and I'm planning to use it again to vote for Joe Biden. But I want to know that he's talking with the Sanders camp and the Warren camp, and that they're going to take our wants and considerations into effect. I would love to see Joe Biden right now announce his running mate because, you know, he's no spring chicken. That person could likely be president. So that's an important consideration. And I want to know who else he's going to surround himself with. And I just hope that he, I wish he would use this time to bring in people and say, these are the people I'm looking at. Do you think, I mean, all the rules are thrown out. Everything is going to have to change now. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, I wonder, the running mate question is a big one, and I don't know whether he'll move quickly on that. But I think the way around that, if he weren't going to move quickly around this, is to sort of say this is what the cabinet looks like. Now, that's going to be weird, because if all of a sudden there isn't a Kamala Harris or there isn't an Elizabeth Warren or there isn't somebody like that, does that just put the running mate conversation into overdrive to say, well, he's kept them out because such and such? So I don't know how he's thinking about that. I sort of agree with you conceptually that it might be time for Joe Biden, who now is the presumptive nominee, to just act like the presumptive nominee, exactly. To act like we're in October, not in April. And I think he's getting that message. And I also think it sounds like from the conversations people have been having, including with Bernie Sanders and with Elizabeth Warren and with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, that the Joe Biden campaign is taking that part of the message seriously. Look, there are things about the Bernie Sanders campaign which were considered quite radical a few years ago that are now mainstream.
That's right.
$15 an hour,
that's,
I remind
right.
people, is $30,000 a year. So yeah. Everybody who thinks that the socialists are taking over and the poor are taking your money, it's $30,000 a year.
Exactly.
The minimum wage is 7.25. That's $15,000 a year. I saw a poll the other day that said 30% of people who identify as conservatives think that universal health care might be a good thing. And I've argued for a long time it actually shouldn't be a liberal or a conservative idea. It's actually
not
a better idea that gets you a better return on your investment. So when you take all of that together, I think that there are things that we thought that now people are saying, you know what, if we had universal health care, we'd probably be in a better position today because there would be a whole bunch of people with underlying conditions who would seek treatment. And who might
exactly.
not die of coronavirus or might not go to work because they could afford to be at home and make somebody else sick. So, you know, I think the world has changed a lot in the last couple of months.
I hope so. And one of the things my calling around the world, I hope, brings to light, I always ask the people in these other countries about their health care systems, and they know what it is over here. But when I mention the insurance card and it's tied to your employment, and then there's co-pays and deductibles, and the people who don't have insurance go bang, it is inconceivable to the rest of the civilized world. If we have one silver lining from this whole mess, hopefully we keep the deaths down, they keep the curve flat, people, yeah. you know, the horror is minimized as much as it can be.
But
we come
really
out on the other end with people knowing that, yeah, we need universal health care. We need a single payer health care system.
Yeah. And look, you think about how many of our major policies have come out of bad things. That's not a bad thing to wish for, right? The idea that good things come out of bad things. The triangle shirtwaist factory meant that workers don't work in rooms that are locked so that if there's a fire, they can't get out. People had to die for us to say, wow, that seems to be a no-brainer. And there are lots of places in the world who don't have basic rules like that.
That's
so
right.
I think that, you know, I used to report on hurricanes and I'd talk about climate change and people would say, this isn't the time. And I've reported on so many mass shootings on site and people have said, this isn't the time to talk about gun control. Well, guess what? It's actually always the time to talk about ways in which we can handle this thing that's happening now differently and better in the future. So I think we can hold both of those thoughts together. We're in a crisis and rule number one is fix that. But let's talk about how we fix this moving forward.
Absolutely. Ali Velshi, I could keep talking to you for an hour. I know I've overstayed my welcome already. Thank you so much. What a pleasure this has been. I do enjoy waking up and watching you weekend mornings. And it's even better when someone's out and I see it's you in the fill-in chair because I trust you and I like you. And now I think you're a friend. So Ali Velshi, find him. His website is at velshi.com. He's on Twitter at Ali Velshi. And of course, you find him on MSNBC pretty much all the time, but certainly Saturday and Sunday mornings from 8 to 10 Eastern. What a pleasure this has been. Thank you so much. It was great meeting you.
Thank you.
Ali Velshi, cool guy, huh? And with that, we reach the end of another edition of The Bradcast. I'm Nicole Sandler, always happy to fill in when I can for Brad and Desi, give them a little free time. Not that we don't all have an abundance of free time these days. Oh, well. Thanks for bearing with me. Come check out my show at NicoleSandler.com anytime. Until next time, to quote Brad, and I mean it with everything I can muster. Good luck, world.